When I got back to the Regia, I heard that my father had given orders that no one was to approach the strangers' camp until he had determined who they were and why they had brought long ships and armed men into the heart of Latium. I said nothing, of course, about my hare-brained exploit, but slipped into the house, washed and put on a clean tunic, and sat spinning away as if I'd never set foot outside the door in my life. The word was that the king was going to send Drances with a party of men to talk to the strangers in the morning. But next day, before Drances even set out, people ran shouting, "They're coming!" And a small troop of foreigners came riding up to the city gates. Their horses looked poorly, as well they might, poor creatures, after a sea voyage, but they were decked out with silver-mounted bridles and trappings, and the men were grand in embroidered cloaks, bronze breastplates, and tall helmets with crests of horsehair or feathers. I could get only a glimpse of the troop from our doorway as they rode up the Via Regia, before the women were sent off to the back of the house. But I saw Aeneas wasn't with them. While Drances and other officials brought them in and escorted them to the king's audience hall, I went through the royal apartments and entered the audience hall through the king's door, behind his seat. He hadn't bidden me to be there, but I had been present with or without my mother at many audiences, as a courtesy to the visitors and to welcome their wives and daughters, and if he didn't want me now, he had only to send me away. I don't think he knew at first that I was there. He was already speaking to the Trojan envoys. He welcomed them with stately courtesy, and asked immediately, though politely, where they came from, and the cause of their visit to Latium. Had they perhaps gone astray, or been driven out of their course on the high seas? A tall, thin Trojan introduced himself as Ilioneus, and in a spate of elegant and respectful language, explained that they had come to the kingdom of the great Latinus, following the command of fate. Natives of the noble city of Troy, which had withstood a 10-year siege by the Greeks, but had fallen at last to treachery, they had escaped from the burning. As the herald spoke, I heard the poet's voice overlapping his, as a sea wave running up the shore overtakes and overlaps the wave before it. I knew then that the high house of the king, and all of us in it, had being only in those words. And that knowledge changed nothing. The messenger still must speak. The king must listen. The king's daughter must follow her fate. The messenger spoke on. Oracles had bidden them bring the gods of Troy over the seas to the far shore of Italy, where they would find a home. Their lord Aeneas, son of Anchises, had led them for 7 years across land and sea, and though other kings had asked them to stay, he would offer alliance only to Latinus, who reigned over the land promised them by the oracle. And in earnest of his goodwill, Aeneas offered to the king some poor fragments, saved from the fallen city, that had belonged to his father's brother, King Priam of Troy. One of the Trojans came forward and laid at my father's feet a marvelous tall libation cup that looked to be of solid gold, carved and jeweled, a silver rod or wand, a thin old gold crown, and a delicate weaving of royal crimson embroidered with gold thread. My father gazed down at these things in silence for some time, neither accepting nor refusing them. At last he asked the envoy to tell him more about the city of Troy and their quarrel with the Greeks, and then something of their 7-year voyage across the Middle Sea, all of which Ilioneus did. My father asked if they had stopped in Sicily, and Ilioneus said they had left a colony there. He asked if they had been in touch with a Greek settlement south of us, whose king was Diomedes, and Ilioneus said that they had not, Diomedes being a veteran of the siege of Troy, and not likely to be well disposed to Trojans. All his answers were both direct and graceful. My father let silence fall again, looking downward, his eyes moving as they followed his thoughts. At last he looked up.
"Oracles, you say. Bad you come to this country," he said. "I will tell you that your coming also was foretold. I think, my friends, that we are to enact what fate will have us do. If your chief Aeneas seeks alliance, if he seeks to settle here with us, I will ask him to come to my city and offer me his hand, even as he has offered me these noble gifts. And I will take it, as I accept them, in sign of friendship and pledge of peace. And say this also to him. My only daughter is bidden by our oracle to marry a stranger, a man who, even as the oracle spoke, was coming to us. I think your lord Aeneas is the man, and if my mind sees truly, this marriage is what I wish. So bid him come." He stood up, and only then, I think, did he see me. But he showed no surprise. He only looked at me with serene, affectionate eyes, a look of perfect certainty, smiling a little. He didn't introduce the envoys to me, but moved among them, admiring their noble gifts, ordering our people to bring out gifts for them. I backed away quietly through the door I had come in. To hear myself promised as part of a treaty, exchanged like a cup or a piece of clothing, might seem as deep an insult as could be offered to a human soul. But slaves and unmarried girls expect such insult, even those of us who have been allowed liberty enough to pretend we are free. My liberty had been great, and so I had dreaded its end, so long as it could end only with Turnus or the other suitors. I had felt that insult, that bondage awaiting me, the only possible outcome. I had been the dove tied to the pole, flapping its silly wings as if it could fly, while the boys below shouted and pointed and shot at it till at last an arrow struck. I felt nothing of that entrapment now, that helpless shame. I felt the same certainty I had seen in my father's eyes. Things were going as they should go, and in going with them, I was free. The string that tied me to the pole had been cut. For the first time I knew what it would be to fly, to take to my wings across the air, across the years to come, to go on. "I will marry him," I said in my heart as I went through the rooms of the Regia. "I will make him my husband, and bring the gods of his house here to join with the gods of mine. I will bring him home." I turned aside and went across the courtyard, past the great laurel tree, to the domed rooms behind the atrium, the storehouses, my domain, where I and the Penates ruled. Before long it would be the fourth month, June. Time to throw open the doors of those storehouses and clean them out, clear them for the new harvest. I sent for a couple of the women who helped me there, and we began making ready for the ceremony, recalling and singing to one another the words of the songs of Vesta and Ceres, fire and bread, while we carried out empty bins and swept the dusty floors. There was commotion all through the house and city, as the gifts Latinus had ordered were brought out, and men chosen to take them. He himself had been out to the stables to select a few good horses, and to send word to Tyrus to have a herd of choice bull calves and a flock of lambs driven to Venticula, so the Trojans could have sacrifice and meat. He knew what a king's hospitality should be, and enjoyed his own generosity. He looked like a young man as he strode across the courtyard, and I watched him with pride. But Amata came hurrying to meet him from the women's quarters, her hair loose, her face white, her voice loud.
"Is it true what they say, husband, that you gave our daughter to a stranger, a foreigner, a man you haven't seen, know nothing of? Is this wise? Is this kind to the girl? And me? Not to say a word to me?"
My father had stopped and stood erect, facing her. The geniality had gone out of his face, and old age had come back into it.
"This isn't the place, Amata."
"I will speak."
"Come with me, then." "You too, Lavinia."
He strode off to the royal apartments, and we followed him. Catching up with Amata, I said,
"Mother, he did as the oracle commanded, and as I myself asked him to do. Truly, I did. This is how it must be. It will be all right."
She didn't even hear me, I think. As soon as we were in Latinus's office, she began to talk, pouring out a torrent of arguments. How could he ruthlessly discard our understanding with Turnus and the other suitors? How could they not see it as a pledge-breaking? What did it matter if the oracle said the marriage must be with a foreigner? Was Rutulia not a different country from Latium? Was Turnus not a foreigner?
"He is a Latin, one of us, one of your house,"
my father said, frowning. I thought it was a mistake for him to answer her arguments at all, and indeed it only inflamed her. She accused him of listening to Drances' counsel, Drances who hated and was jealous of Turnus. Faithful Turnus, who only sought to uphold and support Latinus's throne in his old age. She berated him cruelly for oath-breaking and weakness and indecision, and in the next breath pleaded with him, calling on his strength and wisdom. He stood enduring the flood of words and said nothing, only occasionally shaking his head. At last, as her voice began to get hoarse and shrill, he broke in, also hoarsely.
"The matter is settled. Accept it, Amata. Remember, you are a queen."
And to me he said,
"Take your mother back to her rooms, and comfort her, Lavinia."
I will not go,"
she shrieked, shaking her arms in the air, and she ran out, whirling across the courtyard like a top that children whip into spinning, screaming that the king had given his daughter to a stranger, an enemy, that the king was mad. And she made for the front doors of the Regia. The guards didn't dare touch her, but my women acted very swiftly with me, as if we had planned what to do. We surrounded Amata before she had got far into the streets of the city, and talking and soothing and stroking and urging her along, we got her back into the Regia and to her rooms on the women's side. There, her hysteria turned to a great fit of sobbing, which left her spent and silent at last. I thought that collapse into weariness was final. I thought she had given up. That was stupid of me. So was my failure to understand that what she was saying wasn't only madness or the rage of frustrated desire. She was giving voice to what a great many of our people thought or feared obscurely when they heard what the king had said to the Trojan messenger, that he had welcomed invaders, that scorning his loyal subjects and allies, he had promised to give his daughter, his inheritance, his country, to a stranger. I went to bed that night tired and shaken, but in peace of heart, and slept well. I woke to a craziness that I can remember only in vivid bits and patches, because nothing in it was sane or clear. None of it made sense. I woke in my mother's world. It was dark night. Women with oil lamps were in my room, and one of them was patting my shoulder, saying, "Wake up, king's daughter, wake up, All about me there was bustle, whispering, laughter. As I struggled awake, I saw they were all my mother's women, not mine, and that the slave women were dressed up in fine ceremonial clothes, in my mother's clothes. I heard Amata's voice, and she came in, wearing the coarse, unbleached tunic of a slave.
"Up, up, girl," she said with a smile. "This is the goat feast, the fig feast. We're going to do worship the way my people do, up in the hills. If your father can give you away, I can take you away. Come on, now. We must be there at sunrise."
And I was up, and dressed in an old gray tunic and a ragged shawl, and hurried away among the laughing women, out the back door, through the silent streets of the city, out the postern gate, across the fields, towards the low forested hills that rise east of Laurentum. The tiny oil lamps made a wavering dance down the lane before us and behind us. The eastern skyline was just showing clear against the first beginning of dawn, Mount Alba standing long and dark over the dark world. We left the last Pegasus and entered at once into the forest. Night closed around us. It was hard to see the way. The lamps cast wild shadows through the trees and across the uneven path. Women stopped to free their robes from thorns and entangling branches, but Amata urged them on.
"Don't worry about that. A tear can be mended. We must be up in the hills, up at the fig tree spring, when the sun rises. Come on, hurry along."
And she went back down along the line to encourage the women, house slaves, sweepers and washers and cook's helpers and maids of all work, who were struggling along under heavy loads, baskets and jugs of food and drink. She called them by name, cheered them on, and came whirling back up to the head of the line, laughing and talking.
"Oh, this is an adventure! At last!"
She called to me joyously as she passed me. And indeed there was a wild thrill of strangeness in the hurry and secrecy, the changed costumes, the line of women carrying lights in the forest in the dark. It was all unreal, fantastic, and I was caught up in the excitement of it. We reached the fig tree springs as the sky was brightening. Up in the heart of the hills, a spring breaks out from a ledge of rock on the side of a deep fold in the hillside. And all around below it, on a level meadow, grow huge old wild fig trees, a kind of natural orchard. I had been there once with Sylvia in summer to feast on the black fruit. But we had heard swine grunting and crashing all about, drawn by the fallen fruit, and so didn't stay long. A wild boar being about the only thing Sylvia was afraid of. We all straggled up to the grassy level under the trees and set down burdens and drew breath for a while. Amata stood and talked to us, telling us that this was the festival of the Caprotini, as the Rutilians celebrated it in their hills, a festival of women, for women only. "We will set guards," she said. "If a man comes near us, he must be driven away. If he refuses to go, or if he tries to spy on us, it's death for him, worse than death. For if he spies on our mysteries, that's the end of his manhood. He'll go back down the mountain a eunuch." Belina brought four sharp swords with her, and four strong women will keep watch day and night on the paths, and the powers of the hills and wilderness wait to curse the man who dares approach us. For Mars must stay below us here. Mars must keep down at the field's edge and the forest's edge, standing on his boundaries. The heights and the wild forests are ours, ours alone, for our worship and our revels. And look, look, the sun rises. Greet the day, sisters. Sikana, open a wine jug, pass it around.
So the day began with drinking, and by noon some of the women were too drunk to dance. They laughed and screeched and vomited and fell over and slept where they fell. Amata taught us the dances and songs of her Caprotini,
and a sacred game in which the older women tried to catch the younger ones and whip them with fig branches, shouting out crude joking songs about men's penises and women's vulvas. And we held other ceremonies at altars we raised to Fauna of the wilderness, and the Juno of women, and Ceres, who swells the seed in the womb of earth to be born as the bread of life. Slaves were sent back down to the city to fetch more wine. During the day, groups of women began to straggle in, coming from other households in the city, drawn by curiosity about this new women's right and by solidarity with their queen. I found myself in an odd position with these townswomen, who were all outraged for me and enraged at my father. They hung about me to commiserate and pet me and encourage me in my love and fidelity to Turnus of Ardea. Their indignation and kindness were real and touching, and yet as unreal as all the rest of this escape, this mistake. I played the part of the meek, voiceless maiden all through this masquerade up in the hills. I couldn't bring myself to tell these sympathetic matrons that I had no love at all for Turnus, and wanted only to obey my father and the oracle. To do so would be to betray my mother, and to turn her rage against me. I was a coward. I felt false, frightened, incredulous, scornful, and alone. My mother had brought none of my women up here to the hills, only her women, and for all her wild gaiety and seeming abandon, she never let me out of her sight. I was very glad when I saw, among the last group of newcomers, Maruna. She had put on my best pala, for that was the rule, the servant to dress as mistress and the mistress as servant. I winked at her, to let her know I'd seen her, and seen my best pala, too, but we kept our distance and didn't speak. Slight and quiet, Maruna had a gift of going unnoticed, very useful to a slave. She kept with the group she'd come with, and did as all the others did, and I think my mother never noticed her. During the evening, Amata began to drink. She had only tasted and pretended till then. And by nightfall, she wasn't drunk, but mellowed, less hectic, and enjoying the escapade far more than she had pretended to till then. Her laugh came from deep in her belly. I had never heard her laugh like that. It made her seem strange, another woman, a woman she might have been. I felt an aching pang of grief for her. Lavinia, she called me, and when I came to her, picking my way among the women sprawled about in the grass amid the little flickering oil lamps and the low boughs of the great fig trees, Lavinia, I sent for him, last night, before we left. I sent a messenger on horseback. He should be here tomorrow. Your wedding night, my darling. I knew who he was, and what she meant. It was all part of the craziness, the unreality. But in her game, I had to play the game. How will he know where to come? The women will tell him. They're looking out for him. They'll catch him before he ever gets into the city. He should be here by this time tomorrow. But men aren't allowed here among us, I said.
Oh, this one is,
my mother said, in that deep, melting, laughing voice. She pulled at my hand to make me sit down beside her. She leaned close to me and whispered in my ear,
There will be such a wedding night here in the hills. And then to Ardea. Home to Ardea. It's all planned. All planned.
She kept me by her all night. I had to sleep close to her and the group of women she was drinking and gambling with, in the light of their lamps fixed on low branches. I slept only in snatches all night long, waking up always with a start, my mind racing. I kept telling myself not to worry. All I had to do was go along with whatever my mother wanted until her game played itself out, as it must, in confusion and disillusion and retreat. But she had sent for Turnus. What if he came? What if she handed me over to him in a mock wedding, a real rape? What if he took me off to Ardea? There would be nothing, nothing I could do. At the thought, my body went stiff, my hands clenched, and I hid my face in my arms. I had to get away from here. I had to find a way to escape. But even if I could creep away, I couldn't find my way through the forest in the dark. The guards were watching the path we had come by, and it was a long way through wild, broken hills. The best I could hope for was to get far enough away to hide for the rest of the night, and then follow a stream down to the lowlands. But my mother's women were all around me, still awake, the tiny lamps still flickering, and beyond them, the guards. The same series of thoughts, the effort to reassure myself, the shock of thinking Turnus might come, the attempt to imagine a way to escape, repeated itself in my head, round and round, again and again, all night. Sometimes I slept and had snatches of dreams of my poet, not in the altar place of Albunea, but here, in the wild hills. He seemed to be nearby, near one of the oil lamps, but he was deformed, shrunken into a stump of shadow, mumbling words I couldn't understand. Then I would wake to the endless repetition of the same thoughts. I got up at the first hint of light. Seeing Amata asleep at last among her women, I slipped away towards the dell we had been using as a place to piss, and for a moment I thought I could simply walk on. But just past the dell, Gaia was standing on guard, leaning on a naked sword as if it were a cane. She greeted me loudly, with a stupid smile. She was a sweeper, not quite right in her wits. She was devoted to my mother, as were many of these women. If Amata had told her not to let me pass, she wouldn't let me pass. Amata wasn't a particularly kind mistress. She showed little affection, but she wasn't stingy, not cruel, and didn't play favorites. That was more than enough to win loyalty. And her grief for her lost sons gave her a kind of sanctity among the women of her household. The poor queen, I had heard them say a thousand times, and it never seemed strange to me that they still pitied her. They were right. She was an unhappy woman. Many of us slept late and got up staggering. Food and drink had nearly given out, and groups went down to Laurentum to bring stores from their own storehouses and from the Regia. There was a good deal of coming and going, but I couldn't slip away or join a group going down to the city, as I hoped, for if Amata wasn't with me, Tall Sicana and Dour Lina always were, keeping watch. I and some slave girls were the only young women here. The city matrons had left their virgin daughters safe at home. But women with babies at the breast had, of course, brought their nurslings, and I passed much of the day relieving tired mothers by rocking fretful babies. It saved me from having to talk with half-drunken adults, and the babies were a relief from the falseness, the insanity of what we were doing. They were solid, real, and needy. They were too young to imagine anything. Looking after them was a comfort to me, for which, of course, I was overpraised and flattered. Look how kind the king's daughter is to the slave's child. Look how kind the slave's child is to the king's daughter, I thought, as a sweet, languid little girl smiled up at me, falling asleep in my arms. Amata organized dances and whipping games in the afternoon, but they lacked the wild spontaneity of the first day. Everyone knew by now that Amata was expecting Turnus to arrive, and that she meant to marry me to him. Many women were uneasy with the idea of his coming, feeling, I think, like heifers who jump the fence and found themselves in the bull's pasture. And the notion of a marriage so far from the doorway of the house and the Penates and Larrys of the family and the city was puzzling and shocking to us all. How could you get married in the wilderness, where none of the domestic powers could help you, and the local powers and spirits had no care for human matters and might well be malevolent? Though Amata continued to talk of a wedding, the others dealt with it by speaking of it as a betrothal. That was something they could look forward to as plausible. So they kept their expectation high all afternoon and evening. When night came, and Turnus had not, Amata began to drink again, and urge us all to drink. The dances and songs soon broke up into aimless, foolish noisiness. Yet through it all my mother kept me close beside her, with Lina and Sikana. And the guards with swords didn't drink, but spelled each other on duty all night long, waiting out of sight down the path. Next day, a good many women slipped away quietly, and some groups that went down to bring food and drink didn't come back. I thought it likely they had lost heart for trudging back and forth, but Amata said their men had locked them up, threatening to beat them if they ran off to the hills again. She ranted about what would happen to those men if they tried to come up here. All our women she sent to the Regia came back, laden with wine and bread. No one had hindered them from raiding the storerooms, and they were told the king had given orders that the women performing religious rites up in the hills weren't to be disturbed. But they said also that people were talking about some kind of quarrel with a hunting party of the strangers in the forest, between Laurentum and the river. As the day wore on, many of us felt light-headed from little food and much wine and the strangeness of irresponsibility. There was a good deal of weeping, crazy laughter, shouting, quarreling. As I sat with Tullia's year-old boy, who was teething, trying to soothe him with a lullaby, Maruna appeared beside me for a moment. "Tonight," she murmured, and I nodded, not looking at her. She whispered, "Owl," and was gone again. "Doro, Doro, Dormiu," I sang to the baby. "Papa has a ring for you." And wondered what Maruna meant. All I could do was wait and find out. "You like babies, don't you?" my mother said to me, standing above me in her soiled, ragged slave's tunic. Her legs were white and shapely, with fine, soft, black hair on the shins and calves. She looked down at the child in my arms, her face contorted as if she had a toothache. "He'll breed you," she said. "You can count on that. He's not like the old eunuch. He'll breed sons who live." She spoke clearly, with detachment. She was drunk, the way I'd seen men at feasts be drunk. Day and night drunk. Drunk to the bone. I didn't reply, but went on with a lullaby in an undertone, for the baby was beginning to relax at last. I didn't want to look up at my mother. I knew her anger was gathering to burst out again. I knew she knew Turnus wasn't going to come. I was very much afraid of her. "Doro, Doro, Dormiu," she sang, mocking. "What are you, lamb? What a eunuch's daughter you are, Lavinia. All milk and meekness. All obedience to your dear papa who makes up oracles to suit himself. Don't think you're going to have it your way this time. I go where you go. You come with me, my girl. You come with me to Ardea tomorrow." I bowed my head and said nothing. The child felt the tension in my arms and began to whimper again.
Shut the brat up, Amata said, turning away. Sikana, where's the jug?
It was an endless evening. After Tullia took her baby off, I dozed, sitting with my back against a great old fig tree. My head ached, my muscles were tight, my mind dull, blank. The sun set in clouds behind the endless trees of the forest, and the night came on very dark. Most women fell asleep early. Only Amata's group of gamblers stayed up, still drinking, till even they wore out. My mother came and lay down next to me.
Asleep already, little ewe lamb? She said.
She set down a small oil lamp near her head.
Sleep well. Tomorrow we're off to Ardea. Sleep well. Sleep well.
She bunched up the corner of her pala under her head for a pillow, laid her arm over me, not in an embrace, and lay silent. I felt the weight and warmth of her arm, of her body against mine. I lay looking into the darkness, watching the shadows from the small lamp flame move among leaves and branches. After a long time, and very slowly, I moved out from under the warm, heavy arm that lay across me. My mother sighed, snored once loudly, didn't move. I lay watching the shadows die. I was asleep, but awake, too, for I heard an owl's thin, quavering cry nearby, to my left. Ee, ee, ee. Without thought or pause, I stood up softly and stepped among the sleeping women in that direction. No lamps burned now, but the clouds had thinned, and summer starlight was gray on the grass. The owl called softly from farther away, and I followed. I saw Gaia slumped asleep under a tree like a lump of darkness, her sword standing by her, its point stuck in the ground. I came away from the fig trees, crossed a tiny side stream where I slipped and stumbled, clambered up to a place where trees massed thicker and darker. Maruna was there. I knew her, though I could barely see her. She took my hand, and we went on together. Before long, she murmured, "I think we've lost the path." We had, but we got along for half a mile or so downhill before we came into a stream gully so overhung with trees and overgrown with thickets that we could go no farther in the dark. We waited there some hours, curled up together for warmth, dozing, till the wind came up, as it will do sometimes an hour before the dawn, clearing off the clouds, and the moon gave us enough light to go on. We struck a downhill path and took it. It soon opened into a woodcutter's drag, down which we could run, and we ran. By the time it was light, we were out of the high hills, coming into pastures. I knew the country from my rambles with Sylvia, knew where we were, and could head straight for the city. We came to the southern gate in the bright early morning. It was shut, and there were men guarding it. I went with Maruna to my father's rooms, and at his door I said aloud, "Do you wake, King? Waken." He came out, heavy-eyed, lumbering, huddling his bedclothes about him, and took me in his arms without a word. When he released me, he said,
"Where is your mother?"
"At the fig tree spring."
"She didn't come with you?"
"I escaped from her," I said. He looked uncomprehending, confused. His gray hair was tufted and matted with sleep.
"Escaped?"
"I didn't want to be there," I said in anguish, and then, trying to speak calmly, though I couldn't, "Father, she said she'd sent for Turnus, to betroth me, marry me to him. I don't know. I was afraid he'd come. She kept me guarded. I couldn't get away. I couldn't have got away without Maruna."
"Sent for Turnus."
It was more than the stupidity of arousal from sleep. He didn't understand. He wouldn't understand that his wife had tried to betray him. Feeling that I had already betrayed her, I couldn't say anything.
"I must get your mother and the other women out of the woods,"
he said at last.
"There's been trouble. Fighting. It could be dangerous for them up there. Will she come back today? What is it she's doing there?"
"Women's rights. Dances her people have." I tried to get my mind to think about what really mattered. "If you send to tell her that there's been fighting, that the women there are in danger, I think she'll come back. But send women messengers, Father. Men can't approach. Some of her women are armed."
"But this is madness,"
my father said. I was tired, strained, worn out by all the folly and anxiety of the past days and nights. I stared at him. I said, "She's been mad for 13 years. When the poet sang me The Fall of Troy, his story told of the king's daughter, Cassandra, who foresaw what would happen and tried to prevent the Trojans from letting the great horse into the city, but no one would listen to her. It was a curse laid on her to see the truth and say it and not be heard. It is a curse laid on women more often than on men. Men want the truth to be theirs, their discovery and property. My father didn't hear me.
"Wait," he said,
and turned away to his room. I waited. Maruna slipped away and brought a pitcher of water from the well in the courtyard, and I gratefully drank every drop of it, except a little that I poured out to the penates first, and a little that I used to wet the corner of my garment and try to clean my face. I was all dirt and dried sweat. The coarse old tunic was tattered and filthy after our night run, and my best pala that Maruna wore was completely ruined. Maruna and I were mourning over the great snags and tears in it when my father came back, dressed. He looked at us with dull puzzlement.
"You must go get cleaned up, Lavinia," he said.
"I'd like to, Father. But please, what is the trouble? Who is fighting?"
"The Trojans were hunting. I told them they could hunt the forests between Venticula and Laurentum. They have to have food."
He stopped. I asked at last, "Did some of our hunters try to stop them?"
"They shot the deer. The stag."
His face was stricken as he said it. I couldn't think what he meant. Why should hunters not shoot a stag? He said,
"Silvia's deer."
"Servius," Maruna whispered.
"The creature ran home, to Tiris's farm, bleeding, with the arrow in its flank, crying like a child," they said. "And Silvia screamed as if it had been her child shot. They couldn't comfort her. Her brothers and the old man swore they'd punish the hunter. But it was the king's son who shot the deer."
"Ascanius," I said. "It begins with a boy who shoots a deer." The waves lapped one over another on the shore where the tide was rising.
"If that is his name."
I had never seen my father bewildered like this. He groped among words and finally said,
"Tiris went into a blind rage, the way he does. He and his boys, they got their farm people together and went out against the hunting party, armed, with swords, axes, bows. They fought. Somewhere over Vilia Ridge, they found the Trojans and tried to slaughter them. But the hunters were soldiers, defending their prince. They killed."
He looked into my face for a moment and looked away.
Tyrus's eldest boy was killed.
First to die is young Almo. You know him. An arrow in his throat chokes off his speech and breath with blood. I whispered his name, as Maruna had whispered the name of the deer.
And old Galysus?
Old Galysus, who's rich and used to being in control, tries to keep them from fighting, comes between them, and has his face smashed in for his pains. My father said,
I can't believe it. Galysus tried to interfere, calm them down. He thought young men in a fight would listen to him.
I stood dumb. I stood as I have stood in the shallows of the sea with the tide rising, the waves coming in one over the other, pushing me and drawing away the sand under my feet with the undertow, till all the world was shining and sliding away. I took Maruna's arm, and she helped me stand.
Please let us go, King,
she murmured to my father. And he, finally seeing our filth and tatters and scratched arms, came with us across the courtyard, calling out for women to help us.
Tell me something I have never understood, I say as we sit in the small courtyard, the inmost room of our apartment in the Regia. It is a warm morning of June, and my husband, who has a great capacity for simple enjoyment, is basking in the early sunlight while we have our breakfast of white figs and new milk sweetened with honey.
I'll do my best, he says.
You might rather not.
Well, let's see.
Why didn't you come to talk with my father right away, when he asked you to come affirm the alliance he offered? The question interests him. He sits up a little straighter to look back to a year ago. It is of great importance to him that he speak truth as nearly as he can, and since it is always hard to speak truly of things in the past, he thinks about it a while before he speaks.
I was getting together some gifts to bring with me, he says. Something that would be suitable for you. A betrothal gift. I'd already sent Priam's cup and crown and scepter. The last best bits of Troy I had. There wasn't anything left, except our gods. But I didn't want to come like a beggar. Euryalus's mother had a shawl woven with silver threads. She'd been keeping it to give to her son's bride when he married. She brought it and offered it to me. Poor soul. Anyhow, while I was worrying about gifts, word came that a band of farmers had attacked our hunting party, because Ascanius had shot a pet stag. Gyas had an arrow nick in his arm, and our men had killed two farmers. That was bad news. A bad beginning. It looked as if the country people weren't going to accept us, no matter what their king said. Then Drances came to our camp by the ships. Did you know that?
No.
He didn't say he was sent by Latinus, or even that Latinus knew he'd come. He'd taken it on himself to warn us that Turnus was using the quarrel with the farmers to raise the whole country against us. Sending off to the Volscians and the Sabines, even to Diomedes down south, for fighting men.
Drances was always envious of Turnus.
I wondered why he came to us. But if I'd gone back with him to Laurentum then, could I have prevented the war?
No, I say. And he doesn't question my certainty. He accepts that I know some things that I couldn't, in the ordinary way, know. He doesn't ask how I know. I have told him that I used to go to the oracle at Albunea with my father, but I have never told him about Poet. I doubt that I ever will. It hasn't been difficult for me to believe in my fictionality, because it is, after all, so slight. But for him, it would be very difficult, even if he is at the moment inactive, domesticated, a contented man sitting in the sunlight talking with his wife, the poet's passionate, commanding, anxious, dangerous hero would find it hard to accept contingents, the nullity of his will and conscience, piety, faithfulness, obedience to what must be rightly done. The fas is the desire of his heart. To know that he has obeyed a poet rather than his conscience might be anguish to him. Even if he saw, as I see, that the poet obeyed his conscience and followed the fas. Why should I trouble him with that, when his concerns are so great and his time so short? He agrees with my judgment, nodding, "It was time for war. Mars on the march. Drances himself said it would be a provocation if I tried to come to the city then. So I hope you see that it wasn't in neglect of my obligation to you and your father that I failed to come. Did you take it as such?" Even if he hasn't worried about it before, his worry about it now is endearing. I want to let him off easily, but perversely I say, "Well, you might have sent a message. I did wonder whether you really wanted the princess as part of the package." He looks appalled, as he always does when he thinks he's been remiss in duty. "Of course," he said. "Of course I did." It was unfair of me to wonder. After all, I had the advantage of you. I'd seen you. He knows that Sylvia and I saw his picnic by the river. I told him about it early on, and the idea of two girls hidden in the bushes spying on an army both shocked and entertained him. And my father could have sent you a message, but he didn't either. So go on about that time. I can tell that he is, for once, disposed to talk, to reminisce. He thinks again for a while and says, "I was undecided that night, perplexed." I am fond of his understatements when he talks about the decisions he has had to make, on which the lives of his people depended. "We simply weren't a large enough force to stand up to a whole countryside determined to drive us away. The answer might be to get back in the ships and go, but where? We'd come where we were to come. That much was clear. So I went off to think about it, down by the river. My thoughts ran about in every direction at once, trying to see what to do, as if my mind was a bowl full of water reflecting a light, and you shake the bowl this way and that, and the reflections dance over the ceiling. They don't come together. And I watched the reflection of the moon on the river shiver and break apart. Then I prayed to the river, Tiber. And while I prayed, there in the reeds under the poplars, my mind grew quieter, and the river gave me my answer. I thought, upriver, Drancy said, is a town with a Greek king. An ally of Latinus, but not on good terms with all the Latins. A foreigner, like us. Maybe he'd help us. And that came to me as the thing to do. All the broken reflections came together. I got some sleep, and next day I took some men upstream in two of the galleys. I left my son in charge of building up our camp so it could be defended. It was time he took some real responsibility. That was a pretty big responsibility for a boy. Well, of course he had Nestheus and Serestus to call on. Good men, experienced. They had full authority from me. But I didn't realize how quickly the Latins would get their troops and their allies together and attack, and burn our ships, so my people had no way to escape. Ah! The memory of that makes him clench his fist and scowl in pain.
I thought I had 8 or 10 days clear to look for some allies of my own. Turnus moved unbelievably fast, a man of immense talent.
Is it self-admiration to admire the man you killed? Is it self-judgment to judge him? I say, he had courage, but not character. He was greedy.
It's hard to ask a young fellow to be selfless,
Aeneas says, with a rueful smile. It seems to be easy enough to expect it of young women. He ponders.
Perhaps women have more complicated selves. They know how to do more than one thing at one time. That comes late to men, if at all. I don't know if I've learned it yet.
He frowns, brooding. He is probably thinking of what he sees as his worst failing, the fury of bloodlust that overcomes him in battle, making him a mindless, indiscriminate slaughterer.
Like a sheepdog gone mad among the sheep, he says.
Of course, much of his reputation as a warrior rests on this battle madness. Men who faced him were terrified of him, and I can't see how it differs from the courage he respects in his heroes, men he has told me of with such admiration. The Trojan Hector, the Greek Achilles. But to him, it is unquestionably a vice, an abuse of skill. Nephas. I know he dreads every threat of war from our neighbors, not because he hates or fears fighting. In fact, he loves it. But he fears himself. He believes that he murdered Turnus. I have argued with him about this. It was in a fair fight. He couldn't leave an implacable, powerful enemy alive, and so on. He couldn't deny my arguments. I drove him to silence. But he hasn't forgiven himself.
Old Vestina appears in the doorway under the colonnade, holding the baby, who twists about in her arms, making a noise like a small bellows being squeezed very fast.
"He's hungry, Queen," she says sternly.
The milk is already bursting from my breasts at the sight of him. "Hand him over," I say, "and get him settled." Although he's so eager, he can't find the nipple at first, and thrashes his fists in fury, gasping indignantly.
"Talk about greed," I say.
My husband's dark eyes rest on me and Silvius with a peaceful, undemanding tenderness. He pours himself another bowl of sweetened milk from the pitcher, dribbles a few drops of it on the ground in worship, and salutes his son with it before he drinks.
"Your health," he says.
I bathed away the filth of the 3 nights spent at the fig tree spring, and slept for a few hours in the middle of the day. But it was hard to rest for long, with all the commotion going on in the courtyard and quarters of the house. Turnus, Turnus. I heard his name constantly. I got up at last and went to find out what was going on. Turnus had come, but not to my mother waiting for him up in the hills. He was out in front of the city gates, they told me, with an army of herdsmen, farmers, and city folk. I climbed up onto the roof of the watchtower to have a look. It was a big crowd, and more coming in across the fields all the time. The men all carried weapons, whether they were farm tools or hunters' bows or swords and bronze-tipped lances. As they grouped together, they made a dark, endless noise. I looked down from the roof at the top of the laurel in the courtyard, where the bees had swarmed. But these men weren't the foreigners the bees had foretold. They were Latins, Laurentians, Italians. My people. My enemies. All that evening the fields were full of armed men. They camped all over the field of exercise and under the slopes of the outer rampart. Next morning I went up to the roof
over the front door to look. The crowds outside the city gate and in the city, filling the streets around the Regia, had doubled. Every now and then a shout went up. "War," they shouted. "War! Drive out the strangers. Send the murderers back where they came from." I saw a group making their way through the others. Some of them were men I knew, herdsmen. They were carrying something long and heavy wrapped in a white cloth stained with blood.
"Almo! Almo!" they chanted. "Avenge our brother! Avenge our dead!"
I glimpsed Almo's and Sylvia's father, Tyrus, among them, white-haired, staring wild-eyed, staggering along, half-carried by other men. This procession made its way up the street towards the doors of the Regia. There they laid the burden down. The shouting was frenzied now. The air shook and rocked with it. And I saw Turnus. He stood in front of the gates of the king's house, facing the crowd.
"Are we to be ruled by strangers?" he shouted.
And the crowd all round shouted like thunder in the streets,
"No!"
"Is my promised bride to be given to a foreigner?"
"No!"
"Latinus, king of Latium, I stand at your gates. We demand justice. We demand war."
And the men all shouted,
"War!"
After what seemed a long time, the doors of the Regia opened. My father came out, flanked by his guards, with Drances and a few other old counselors. The shouting died down. Men near and farther called,
"The king! The king speaks!"
Looking down from almost directly above, as I knelt hidden behind the decorative edge tiles of the roof, I could see only the top of my father's head, gray hair gone thin on the skull.
"Men of Latium, my children," he said in his strong voice,
and paused for a long time, so long it seemed he might not speak again. Men shifted from foot to foot. At last he went on, but sounding now more like an old man.
"An oracle has spoken. A promise has been given. If you defy the voice that guides us, if you break the treaty I made, you do wrong. You will pay for that wrongdoing in blood. You know that. That is all I can say to you. Turnus, son of my old friend Donus, and sister son of my wife, if you are determined to lead our people into this guilt, I cannot stop you. I can only say that you rob me of the harbor of peace I hoped for in my last years, the righteous death I longed for."
The silence continued. Without waiting for any answer, Latinus turned away and came back into the Regia. His guards closed the high doors behind him, leaving Turnus and the crowds outside, still silent for a little. Then the murmuring and the dark noise began again, and swelled, and grew till it surrounded the house and filled the city. Now there was a new turmoil in the streets behind the house. I wasn't the only one up there on the roofs. Maruna and Tita and several girls were up on the watchtower platform over the southeast corner of the house, and one of them was pointing to the east gate. I ran to join them. From the platform we saw another procession straggling up the streets. Women, slaves and mistresses, brazen or calm, shamefaced or proud, all with wild hair, with soiled, torn togas and tunics. Amata and her troop from the fig tree spring. My mother came into the place in front of the Regia, walking as always with a regal gait. Turnus hurried to meet her there. They met and embraced and talked for a while. Presently a new chant began among the men around them.
Open the war gate! Open the war gate!
The war gate of Laurentum stands in a little square not far from the actual city gates, a pair of tall, bronze-studded oaken doors in a frame of cedar, with an altar of Janus to the east of it and an empty space around it. The doors always stood closed and barred, old and grim and meaningless. There had never been any ceremony there in my lifetime, except at the calends of every January when we made libations to Janus. But now everybody was shouting.
The Queen! The Queen will open the war gate!
And the crowds were flowing down that way. I could make out my mother for a while among them, and Turnus's high helmet crest. Then the trees cut off my view, and I could only hear the shouting. A great cheer went up of,
Mars! Mavors! Macte esto!
And people came dancing and calling that the gate of war was open.